everyone. Welcome to this week's episode of the Data Protection Made Easy podcast with me, Jasmine Harrison. And I am joined this week by the returning Phil Brining and Zara and Joe, our special guests to talk about international transfers. So hello.
Hello.
You're on mute, Joe. 2023 and it's still
crying out loud. Hello.
Good session. Do you think it was a good session? We covered quite a lot of ground, didn't we?
I thought it was a great session. I think, you know, we really got stuck into BCRs more than I intended, to be honest. But there's loads to talk about around that. You know, different perceptions or conceptions of it. We discussed, you know, who it applies to. So whether a UK organisation can then freely transfer data to an international organisation that has approved BCRs or not, or whether it's just intergroup sharing. So listen out for that. We also covered, you know, what adequacy is, our issues faced with transfer risk assessments. There was loads of contributions, you know, in the chat, and people are muting. It was great. So yeah, what were your thoughts?
Well, I thought it was good. I mean, it was really great to get some interaction from people working in, you know, big multinational organizations, because they just give a different perspective, don't they? And a very you know, practical, pragmatic perspective. You know, they need to get a job done, and you know, and it truly is international. You know, not all about America. Again, this point was coming out loud and clear. Yeah. You know, we're not just concerned about America. You know, we're concerned about, you know, transfers in to other regimes and other countries. So I thought it was a good session. You know, we did cover a lot of ground. I think there's always more to cover on this, and
always,
You know, there's such a lot of paperwork to read to get your head around it all as well. It's all bitty into all over the ICO's website and the EDP. But what strikes me about the ICO, you know, you read a lot of their stuff, and they say, you know, the European Data Protection Board have published this opinion, which is not binding but is useful to read, and we'll be publishing our own opinion soon. And what we do in the meantime.
Well, even still, you know, with new guidance on the ICO's website, I don't know if they've updated it yet, but they don't track change it. They don't have updates, you know.
It's a nightmare to try and use it.
Yeah, so
I printed, looking for international transfers in prep for this. I ended up on their guide to the GDPR, dated 14th of October, version 1.1.17. I was on page, it's like 359 pages. But again, there's no, you know, that's where you get taken to when you click on the link, you know, download this thing, you know, and it isn't the same as what's on the web page. That's really frustrating. It's really hard
to navigate. But yeah, on the session, we also had the return of Dave Soapbox. So unfortunately, it's not David Holmes. I would dearly miss David Holmes. He's not dead for those who knew, even though it sounds like he is. A new David, who was welcome to join anytime, because he gave some great insight into, you know, encryption and the implications around that as well. But Joe, it was your first session. How did you find it?
Yeah, it was really good. It was a little bit strange, I think, but I really enjoyed it. And international transfers is something that I do really enjoy working on here at DPP. So it was good. And I enjoyed talking around adequacy. We touched a little bit around the new bill that's proposed by UK Parliament and how that may potentially impact the UK's adequacy decision from the EU, and the possibility of us hopefully trying to get adequacy decision with the US as well. So yeah, I really enjoyed it, and I'd love to do it again.
Yeah, you did a great job. I think you know, some people in the chat were vouching for you to be a new host, so hint hint.
Were they? I missed that, and I will I'll continue to turn a blind eye to that, Jasmine, because I think you're doing a great job.
Thank you. Well, without further ado, let's go into the main session, and I hope you all enjoy it. Thank you both again for joining me, and enjoy the show. Before we get started in the main bulk of the session, have you seen anything in the news this week?
Yes, actually, I've seen a little bit. So ISO have actually released two new accreditations dedicated to our sector. One of them is called the ISO 27559, and it's around information security, cybersecurity, and privacy protection. It's privacy enhancing data de-identification framework. Okay. And the purpose of this framework is to identify various risks and mitigate them across the life cycle of de-identified data. So the process is removing the association between data and people through a range of different possible de-identification techniques is one aspect of the standard, as is governance of the process and the resulting data to ensure risks are monitored and addressed as the need arises.
That's interesting. I think that'll be really useful for organisations because there is, you know, a lot of misconceptions around anonymisation of data. I think, you know, obviously personal data relates to an identified or identifiable living individual, but just because you take someone's name away doesn't mean that they can't then be identified through information. So I guess, you know, if you relate that to equality, diversity and inclusion data, if there's one person of Black origin and Christian faith in an organization, then they can be identified as that individual. So yeah, I'm intrigued to see.
I'd be interesting to have to get a Cafe to buy a copy of that then, that standard, because it'd be interesting how what it says different or similar to the ICO's guidance on anonymization.
Because we've had a case in support recently, it's kind of ongoing at the moment, where a client is sending out surveys to about 20,000. They're expecting about 20,000 respondents to come back to them on it. And within that survey, they're going to collect information about ethnicity, religion, sexuality. And when it comes back to them, it's going to be anonymized, well, de-identified in whatever way they can. So they're going to take out the name of the respondent, they're going to take out their postal address, but they'll still have the rest of the data remaining. And the question that we've posed to them is, could there be responses so granular in relation to ethnicity, religion, sexuality, where there's one individual who you could identify as being, you know, because they're in the minority of each of these groups, say, who could be identified apart from everyone, aside from everyone else and all the other respondents? And if so, would that be personal data? If it's like information in relation to an identifiable individual.
I like your thought process there about de-identified being different from anonymized. It's kind of a lesser step, or first step, isn't it, to de-identify, but then is it anonymized? That's a different thing altogether, I guess. It's a good way of thinking about it, Dara.
We've got a client that I do work with. We talk about, is it de-identified or is it anonymized? Because anonymized means you can in no way identify the individual, whereas de-identified doesn't have that same implication on the wording. Because it is possible in the situation that I've got with a client that the individual can then identify themselves and collect this information about them, and so they'll become re-identified. So we can't say it's anonymized, because if there exists the fact that it's going to be re-identified, we can't say they'll in no way become identified, and it's quite likely the individual will identify themselves. So yeah, that's where that term's come from me anyway.
I like it.
But yeah, an interesting point there though with anonymization. It just shows that it's not quite as black and white as easy as you might think, that you just take away a name or take away whatever unique identifier there is, and then that's it. You know, they're no identifier because the information can identify them itself.
Yeah. Well, I have to get hold of a copy of that standard. Well noticed, Joe.
Yeah, well, actually, interestingly enough, while we're still on this, ISO have also released another one at the start of February on consumer protection, which is around privacy by design for consumer goods and services. So because this was only published at the back end of last month, I'm yet to see this to provide a full summary. 31,700. However, I think it is a step in the right direction in terms of protecting personal data and guiding organizations to embed privacy into the foundations of a business, you know, which it's been encouraged a lot recently through the ICO.
Yeah, I think one issue, you know, in the past with ISO is that, say, for example, with ISO 27001, people think that, you know, if they meet that standard, then they comply with data protection, in inverted commas, whereas, you know, that only provides some, you know, I guess, oversight or measures with regards to information security management systems. So the principle of integrity and confidentiality, you know, it helps look at that, but it's not a whole holistic picture.
Not a silver bullet, is it?
Yeah, exactly. And a lot of people misinterpret that. So hopefully this, you know, will open people's eyes to the wormhole that is data protection.
Wormhole.
Why did that sound like you thought that was delicious?
I've never heard that before, Jasmine.
So what else have you seen in the news? Anything else?
Yeah, there's been some news around TikTok. So TikTok is,
I saw that, yeah.
I'm sure everyone knows what TikTok is. It's social media, but it's owned in China. And therefore, there's been quite a lot of controversy about the use of it and the implications of Chinese government having access to this data, etc. So it's been, I believe there's been a few countries that have basically said that their governments and government officials are not to use TikTok. And Belgium has now joined this list of countries who will not let their government officials use the app on their devices, or government issued devices, let me clarify there. So that's another interesting point, with leads on to international data transfers, I guess, going forwards, but an interesting point about how governments feel about this, and even whether there is going to be surveillance or not, the risk of it and how they feel about it, really.
Yeah, I've got something to add to that, but before I do, Michael, would you like to unmute and speak up?
Yeah, I just want to say, like, I heard that there was something that was raised when they were talking about Huawei managing maybe 5G in UK. They said that the BBC said this. I might be wrong, so please call me blind if you want to. But there was a mention that there is actually a law in China where if they feel under threat, the government can use whatever businesses or programs or softwares to fight back against the potential enemy. So that could be, you know, if they have information on the government and they can, you know, leak that information, or they have any links to any of their phones, they could potentially cripple the government some way because they feel threatened. And potentially with this crisis for Ukraine, they could maybe argue that they need to do that because they don't have a very different process to us. So that might be one of the reasons the government is suddenly being warned as a huge risk of their TikTok videos and the biometric data that they put on there could be used to cause chaos, you know, like that video that was on the internet where there was someone pretending to be her and giving a Christmas message. Imagine if we just got like Rishi Sunak and Boris Johnson on there telling everybody to, you know, send them all their passcodes on in an email. They'd probably do it.
I mean, it won't be so ridiculous.
Because the UK's banned TikTok from government mobiles as well, hasn't it?
I read that as well.
That happened this week, yeah.
Yeah.
And there's been, Alexis has raised the Hikvision CCTV cameras. Again, I think there's a lot of worry. In fact, one of the guys I was in Spain with last week is a recruitment, has a recruitment business. And he said he found some brilliant candidates for an UK energy supplier, but they were Chinese and they got rejected on the basis of them being Chinese foreign nationals. I think there's a lot of concern, about espionage and misuse of data from a variety of sources. But lots of things are made in other countries these days, aren't they? We've kind of dismantled our manufacturing base.
Yeah,
makes you wonder where autonomous vehicles and a variety of other products might, you know, where you've got data flowing from Internet of Things devices, you know, what does that build up over a long term? Mm-hmm. Anyway, yes,
it's a big one to unpack, that one, Phil.
if you're only wondering why people would use, I don't think I've ever used TikTok, but that's just something about me, mm-hmm. intergenerational thing. But why would you one be allowed to download onto work device and two be able to use it on a work device? It's a good point.
Go ahead, Jay.
Yes, sorry, I was just going to say, Phil, I think it's a good point, but I think in terms of marketing for an organization, TikTok is now a fundamental to that. Social media has absolutely exploded over the last couple of years, especially since COVID, and that was where TikTok really really gathered some pace in the world. However, having said that, in terms of government officials, I completely agree. I don't really see the value in any government officials or any staff that relate to that industry, why they would need it. But I think for people like us, our customers, TikTok is a real great platform for marketing, and it is beneficial.
I did read, though, that one reason why the UK Parliament at least was reluctant to enforce this immediate action to remove TikTok from government devices is because it's used as a mechanism to reach out to younger people. So obviously, you know, there's still the security concerns around it, but that was the reason, I think, or so one reason at least.
Yeah, what's the issue? Is it the fact that TikTok then might access other data on that device and then exfiltrate it to?
I'm not sure.
I guess that must be it. It's China.
Yeah, that must be the
question.
Yeah.
I think because you can, you know, you can start to profile people, and you don't know what you don't. I guess you don't know the reach that.
The reason, sorry, can I come in here? The reason why TikTok is a concern is because apparently on some of the shares and directorships of owning TikTok per se, some of it is related back to Chinese government officials or companies or organizations related to it. So, but then from what I led to believe, TikTok. Obviously, it's a big company its own, and some of the shareholders in it or people on the higher echelons and the board and stuff like that, I do relate back to government people. That's what I believe. Alleged.
As well, alleged. You know, as Michael said before, thank you for that. But as Michael said before as well, you know, Chinese intelligence laws do require firms to help the Communist Party when requested as well. I also read that on the BBC, so ignore me if my site is also failing.
So the issue isn't really using TikTok to promote your business, is it? The issue is that having TikTok on a device that then potentially, you know, the app on that device might access other data that it shouldn't do. I mean, maybe, you know, you allow it to use your camera, don't you? I suppose you can take videos. So then it might have access to your gallery, and then it knows where you've been, and then it can, you know, so... especially with the metadata attached to photographs. I think that is going to be the key issue, isn't it? That this data, you know, dragged out from government officials, devices the world over, is going to build up, potentially build up some sort of picture that might, one, provide vulnerabilities, and two, might be a route for, you know, a novel way of phishing or spam or that type of attack.
Mm. Sorry, I'm just reading the chat as you're talking.
What always surprises me is that you end up with a load of pictures. You look through your gallery and you end up with a ton of pictures in there from other people's WhatsApp messages. You know, so if somebody's posted that, send you a video, it ends up in your gallery, doesn't it? So just kind of extending that out, thinking that, you know, the potentially the images could be, I don't know, can they? Inserted into a user's gallery, or, you know, malicious software could be inserted via an app that was misbehaving.
Yeah, now you mentioned that, to be fair, I didn't read fully into it, but I do know, I think it was the Austrian, a group, you know, an activist group for data protection in Austria won a case against Meta for data privacy concerns. I would have to read more into that and, you know, talk about it next week, but I guess they're all the same in some ways, aren't they? So it's not just TikTok that you have to be wary of with these things.
No, Victoria's raising really good points as well, that in, you know, the school sector, you know, use of TikTok could be, you know, very you know, high risk and dangerous.
Yeah. And Marie said the risk is using any app without bottoming out and accepting or not accepting the risks to you and the data you hold. Mm. Exactly. Yeah. It all ties in quite nicely, to be fair, with this session on international transfers. So, yeah, you will have heard me refer to Joe as Mr. International. But in actual fact, Zara and Joe are the dream duo when it comes to international transfers. You know, they've been getting stuck into transfer risk assessments, what seems to be on a weekly basis at the minute. It's quite rife. So, Joe, would you like to give us a little bit of background into, you know, what international transfers are, set the scene really, and then we can talk about it in more detail throughout the session.
Yeah, of course. So an international personal data transfer is when an organisation is looking to transfer personal data outside of the UK, from our perspective anyway. So I think the key to it is understanding two areas for me personally. It's what data is involved and where is it going to? So I think that really drives then what organizations need to have in place to, you know, ensure that you're complying with the law. So to start off, if the data is going outside of the UK, the first thing you need to probably decide is it going to a territory that has an adequacy decision? If the answer is yes, then you'll need a data processing agreement or a data sharing agreement in place, depending on the relationship between the two parties. But then if sorry, go on, Phil.
Yes, yeah, so we call these restricted transfers these days, don't we?
Yes.
In the UK.
Yeah.
Just to add a little bit of confusion.
Yeah, there's a lot of different names for a lot of different things within international transfers, and that's where it can get quite tricky as well. So if you are transferring personal data to a country outside of the adequacy decision, then under Article 46 of the UK GDPR, you'll need a safeguard. Typically, this will be either an international data transfer agreement or the EU SECs with the addition of the UK addendum. There are other safeguards in place, such as binding corporate rules. I think there's codes of conduct as well that I think could be relied upon. But typically, I think you'll tend to see that there'll be the international data transfer agreement and the EU SECs with the addendum attached.
Yeah.
So we will go
into detail, you know, on all the different safeguards throughout the session, like I said, but we were having a conversation about binding corporate rules in the office. So do you mind just explaining what they are, and then we can float the idea around?
Yeah, certainly. So binding corporate rules are they're a set of rules that entities within the organization, one specific organization, incorporate. So it's an example of a safeguard. They're quite difficult to attain. Not many have them. I think it's they have to be approved by the commissioner. So in our instance, it's the ICO, but they're legally binding and apply to all enforced or every member concerned of the group of undertakings. But they have to be engaged in a joint economic activity, including their employees. So it can be quite tricky. And I think we've had an internal discussion, haven't we, actually, about BCRs and whether they safeguard data from. Sorry, Zara, do you want to explain it? I think you might be better positioned than me.
Yeah. So from our understanding, a BCR is an internal agreement between entities within one organization. So if you've got an international organization like Salesforce have BCRs, so they've got locations in America, they've got locations in England, they've got all across the world. And it means that essentially they've been deemed to have, within all the entities, they've all got an adequate level of protection in place. So they've got sufficient standards to then also apply these binding corporate rules. So data can be shared freely.
How does that differ from standard contractual clause? I mean, it's just a lot of paperwork, isn't it?
Well, I think it's the ICO's approval and the fact that they need to check that every single organization meets a standard, whereas standard contractual clauses are just, you don't have any, you agree to it contractually, but you don't have any kind of assessment of
We
had a debate in the office actually about how far, you know, this safeguard mechanism can be used or relied on. So on the one side, there was me, and I kind of swayed Zara over my side
you
as well. That with binding corporate rules, if an organization, an international organization, has approved binding corporate rules, a UK organization can then transfer data to that international organization or entity freely and wouldn't need an additional safeguard, just, you know, a data processing or a data sharing agreement. Whereas then on the other side, we had Joe and Vicky with the boxing gloves, and and they were saying, no, you can only use BCRs internally. So I guess between intra-group sharing. So we thought we would do a poll and ask everybody listening live what your thoughts are. So Miles, I don't know if you can create that poll for us now.
Should we give a justification of our thoughts on it, and then we could give a poll from that maybe?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I did pre-write the question, so it is there, but we can talk it through while people vote.
So got you mull it over.
Yeah. So go on, Zara, I'll let you.
See, I'm kind of actually in the middle of this now. Like, as in, I see both sides of the argument now, so I'm not sure which one I'd take to, but I understand probably more so, I'm afraid, Jasmine, more so Vicky and Joe's side now, because it's an internal agreement between
at least
the corporations.
People vote first, come on.
It's an internal agreement between companies within, well, organisations within this group, right? And therefore that's where this contract, that's this internal agreement applies to. It doesn't apply to the third parties in the data to them. which makes me think you still need a safeguard when sending this data to a third party as a controller. Sorry. But yeah, but then I understand also if we're saying that they're all, you know, deemed, the ICO has said, you know, they all meet this standard. And they've been approved by the ICO. I think it's the fact they've got this external approval by the ICO that they've all the organisations in this group meet the standard. What are the risks of the transfer? It's kind of akin to an advocacy decision, but just to that organisation, not to the country. So that's where I'm a bit torn at. But yeah. I think the fact that the binding corporate rules don't apply to the organisation sending the data to the other party, that's a bit that makes me think maybe it's just an internal mechanism and we couldn't use it as a safeguard.
Surely the transfer to that third party who've got the binding corporate rules, if that's an adequate safeguard, then it's an adequate safeguard that the data is being transferred into an environment where there's apparently adequate protection for it as it's being processed. So I can't imagine that it would be just for, I'm just trying to flick through the GDPR, see what it says, you know, if it's clear, but can't imagine. I would have thought it would also protect transfers to a BCR enabled approved organisation.
That's what I thought. But apparently we took this up with the ICO. Apparently we are wrong. And 81% of people listening are correct, as I don't like to admit. But I think because the BCRs don't take into account the, you know, the country's legislation. So, for example, if a US company's got approved BCRs, that might still be caught, or that personal data might still be caught by Pfizer. So, which is a Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which allows law enforcement to access personal data of a US organization. So I think that might be where it, I mean, there's a whole thing to put there, because I guess the data transfer agreement does the same, but we'll talk about that in more detail.
I would have thought, because according to the ICO's transfer risk assessments guidance, which I have in my hand here, it says that you know, if you're relying on a transfer under binding corporate rules, you might need to do a TRA still. So, you know, I don't think it's as clear cut as the poll makes out. Personally, I would have thought that if you do a TRA, but what do I know? I'm not in the ICO, am I? But if you do a TRA and you assess the risk to the territory in which you're transferring the data into, and BCRs apply, you know, why would that not be good enough?
Maybe we should set up our own activist group. Challenge.
I mean, we spoke to the ICO last week about something, and again, the guidance came back, and I wasn't convinced it was right. Just their chat, you know, just their support desk people. It was about the PECA, and it was about the soft optim, and it just didn't seem. It seemed too superficial, and you know, the nuances a lot with a lot of these things. You know, it's the nuances, isn't it, that's the important thing.
Yeah, yeah. I know. I had the same issue when I was talking to through the ICO chat. I think I've mentioned it last week, but I think I was annoying the guy on the other side, because I was being as thorough as I could, you know, to make sure that the advice that he gave wasn't just generic.
Oh, I can't at the moment.
Yeah. Oh, so what they're saying on the guidance here, Jasmine, though, is they're saying if you're using one of the Article 46 transfer mechanisms, such as IDTA, the addendum, or BCRs, you know, this guidance will help you understand when to carry out a TRA. Well, surely, you know, we've just discussed is that if there's BCRs in place, there's no need to do a TRA, because that's already been assessed. We're going around in circles with this.
That the BCRs aren't in place between the person transferring the data or the organisation transferring the data to the organisation that's got the BCRs. BCRs are internal to that one organisation.
Yes, yeah.
So the person that's transferring it first, or the organisation,
you probably would need an IDTA in place.
Would need an Article 46 safeguard, such as an IDTA. Yeah, exactly.
Thank you, Mr. International.
Well, how does that differ from international organisations then, Joe? An international organisation such as UNICEF or NATO, whoever they are.
Yeah.
You know, again, we're allowed to transfer data to international organisations, aren't we?
Well, I think it's just intra-group, so it just relates to those. The BCRs, they don't go from one party to another, they're just into one organization. So if they're the people that are transferring the data outside of their organization to an organization that doesn't have BCRs, then they'll need an additional safeguard. So I think the whole point of the BCRs are for onward sharing, or just, so say take example Amazon, for example, you know, they've got bases all around the world. If they want to just quickly transfer,
but they haven't got BCRs.
Well, no, they haven't. I'm just using them as
yeah,
an example.
But Salesforce.
Well, use Salesforce. Yeah. Say Salesforce want to transfer some data from their head office or an office in Ireland, and they want to send it over to America, and they've got BCRs. They can just do that dead quickly. I think it just saves a lot of paperwork. It just makes sure that they don't have to have, say, 30 sets of different SECs or IDTAs to facilitate those transfers. They've just got that one set of BCRs. And I just think it's a lot easier for those organizations to just quickly transfer data inside.
Yeah, I would also think it would be, if you're carrying out a bit of due diligence as well on the supplier that you're using, if they've got BCRs, that's a bit of insurance that within the group they've got a standard that's been approved by the ICO of, you know, having measures in place to help comply with data protection laws in the UK. That would provide me a little bit additional assurance as well.
Mm. I'm just reading the chat here. So Alan said, I got roped into something recently where we had a contract with, is it Acme UK, who used IT, etc. of Acme US, please ignore me if I'm pronouncing that wrong, who was their parent company. The contract included standard contractual clauses, and I think that's master contractual clauses, I could be wrong, but the Acme US privacy policy clearly stated that they use BCRs. So this morning when we was having this conversation, I looked at Salesforce, knowing that they have BCRs, I looked at their data processing addendum. And while they do have BCRs, they also incorporated standard contractual clauses into that as well. So I guess it's the same thing, really. And David has said here that he's fully aligned with Joe. And yeah, there's a little bit of conversation going here. But yeah, just really interesting. Debate. So should we move on to, well, take us, I guess, a step back and talk about adequacy, because there's loads to talk about with that as well. So Joe, would you like to explain to us what it is, when it applies, how it works?
Yeah, sorry Phil, it sounded like you were going to butt in there, or
no,
you got to keep him in check.
Wouldn't dream of butting in, Jane.
Yeah, so adequacy is a term used by the EU for territories that have a essentially equivalent level of protection of personal data. We use the word territories because there are a few countries that have partial adequacy. So that's Japan and Canada. So Japan, the adequacy only relates directly to organizations in the private sector, and Canada only covers data that is subject to Canada's Personal Information Protection and Electronic Documents Act. So not all data is subject to PIPEDA, is it called? I think, I don't know if I've said that right or not, but essentially that is what adequacy is, whether it's essentially equivalent to that of the EU. And obviously we've adopted that because we've just taken the EU's GDPR. Essentially.
Okay. And so there was partial adequacy as well. So could you explain that a little bit?
I just did, Jasmine.
Oh, sorry. I was reading the chat. Okay. Sorry. I don't want to take it a step back, but Marie's put something really good in the chat here. So she said, step one, what are the risks of moving data? You need to do a TRA, transfer risk assessment, to answer that. And in the process, you would identify whether the organization you are using or giving the information to has appropriate mechanisms in place to protect the data, whether that is BCRs, SECs. At the end of the day, you need to have clarity on protection mechanisms and residual risks. And if these are not within tolerance, don't do it. And Jason has also said, before we move on, sorry, BCRs are a great way to lawfully exchange personal data between group entities, but they take years to be approved, which is very true. We have written our own intergroup data sharing agreement incorporating EU SECs and the UK addendum. This does much the same as BCRs, but was much quicker to implement. That's very true.
Doesn't have to go through the approvals process, does it?
Yeah, exactly.
And why did you, I don't know if you want, anyway, was it the time scale, Jason, that you know, as an international organization, then presumably you could have gone down the BCRs route, but was it the complexity or the just the time frames that made you choose this particular way?
It was solely time frames, Phil. We needed to do it immediately because we wanted to start exchanging personal data lawfully between group entities, and we just couldn't stand the idea of a 2 or 3 year time frame to get BCRs confirmed.
Yeah. And is it something you might consider in the future, you know, going down that route? Now you've got a mechanism in place. Is that sufficient, or do you think BCRs would add any value? You know, what's the value that it adds?
Well, we've got a stated intention to grow internationally. So once we start moving outside UK and European jurisdictions, we may have to start looking at BCRs. But at the moment, all of our group entities are within the EEA.
Right. Okay. Great. Well, good luck with that. I know that you love the international transfers dimension, don't you, in your business?
Always have.
Exactly, yes. Dave's asking about any implications. Did he speak last week when I was away about the data protection bill? Is it too early to say, the impact on adequacy?
Yeah, well, it's funny you say that, actually, Phil, because the whole point, supposedly one of the aims of the Data Protection and Digital Information Bill is to ensure that the UK maintains an adequacy decision with the UK. But I actually find it hard to believe that the UK would lose adequacy currently, as the UK GDPR is essentially the same as the EU, and therefore meets the threshold of the EU's adequacy decision of it being essentially equivalent. So I think.
But what if it got changed? You know, what about the changes? Are the changes like to undermine? I don't think it's easy to tell actually at this point in time.
Yeah.
I think it's a great point raised by Alexis. I have the same question on the ICO's TRA tool. Then you know, there's a list of different types of data items, and then kind of a ranking as to whether they're high, medium, or low risk. And gender, you're quite right, is set up as a high risk. And there's other ones like, financial information, termination date from employment is set up as high risk as well. So a good question, how do we align all that type of stuff with special category data? You know, this is probably classified as sensitive data rather than special category data. It's not defined as such. But again, when you read through it, you think, oh, I wonder why that is. Marital history, moderate risk. Genetic data, obviously high, trade union membership, all that type of stuff that we know about, high, but termination details, health and safety records, high risk, financial, credit card details, high risk. We can understand some of it, but it's just that alignment with the special category data. Again, I asked the same question when I was reading it as well.
Yeah, so I guess, as part of this with future adequacy, the new bill comes into it, or the new Data Protection and Digital Information Act. So we'll see how that one progresses. But Zara, would you like to explain the potential implications of it?
Well, yeah. So one of the parts of the bill is talking about how the UK would determine its own adequacy decisions. Currently it is for territories that are essentially equivalent in their data protection standards to ours. But this is going to be potentially lowered to basically whether the third country is materially lower or not. So if it's materially lower, then it won't meet the threshold. But it's obviously a lower threshold than being essentially equivalent. And so there's this gap in between where it's not materially lower. And I think there's a lot of speculation around it, whether this is to try and push forward an adequacy decision with America, because that's something that obviously we do a lot of business with American organizations. So it would make life a bit easier if you didn't have to do have agreements in place anyway for American organizations, not have to do transfer risk assessments. The concern with this is that the EU, what this could result in is essentially European organizations could send data to the UK through adequacy, and then from the UK it could then go to America through adequacy, and that would bypass the need to have any additional mechanisms for the transfer of EU data to America. So I think the EU wouldn't like this because they want to be in control whether the America is granted adequacy or not. So I don't think it's gonna, if it, I don't think it's gonna land well with the EU at all. And I think that's something that could potentially threaten our adequacy with the EU. I obviously at this stage it's all very speculative. It's not being enforced yet. Obviously it's still a bill, and I'm not sure what the changes might be. Whether there will be any changes. GDPR is not that old, so we'll see what happens. But I suppose there'll also be the thought of, well, what's more of a cost to the UK and our businesses is gaining adequacy with America. Will that be more beneficial than losing adequacy to the EU, or so maintaining adequacy with the EU and keeping it as it is? Because obviously at the moment there's quite a lot of measures in place for transferring data to America. It's common obviously with the EU data to send it, you know, a load of American websites, American organizations on their websites will have within their contracts, they'll have the EU SECs and the UK addendum. So it's already that kind of mechanism for transferring data to America. So is there any need to change the status quo in getting adequacy with America and losing it with the EU? I'm not sure, but that's all to be, I guess, determined by government.
Yeah, I think it's ironic, you know, with the new bill, Parliament are proposing that you can, that the UK will save 4.7 billion, you know, through businesses, but I don't think they've factored in the possibility of losing EU adequacy.
But the EU wants to, they want adequacy with the United States. That's why they've had Safe Harbor. Yeah. That's why they've had Privacy Shield. It keeps getting knocked back. Yeah, they're negotiating with the, you know, executive order, etc., to try and get to a point where they're happy with the arrangements there. So I think it'd be reckless to kind of kick the baby out of the bath with the bathwater and go off on our own and lose adequacy to the EU, because the EU is moving that way anyway. May as well just wait and wait for them to get there. But
it will be interesting to see how that actually pans out, though, because there are difficulties with it. I was watching a podcast. It was from a few months ago before the most recent redress of the executive order was released. But it was from, you know, I guess the US perspective, saying, you know, we've made these changes. We're really confident with how, you know, it's going to be put forward, etc. But it still doesn't really cover the fact that the EU and the US have different, legal structures. So you can't, the way they currently stand, they don't have a independent body, you know, to enforce rights and things like that. And it will be difficult to actually, I guess, require the Attorney General to, you know, delegate some of his responsibilities.
I think that would be straightforward. I mean, Germany's a federation.
It doesn't seem to be so far.
Well,
but
there's 14 data protection authorities in Germany and then one national data protection authority. Surely it's the same structure as that. I think it's a cultural thing, personally. You know, if you want to set up a society to have these kind of protections and rights, then that's how you set it up. And if you don't, because you're worried about it, or you want your government bodies to have overriding rights that supersede those of individuals, then that's a big cultural thing.
I think probably at the minute, you know, they're just trying to find a way of avoiding that, but we'll see how it pans out and what they prioritise, really.
There's been a few questions just about the chat about this, the TRA tool, which is really hard to get to, because whilst it's a downloadable Word document, so I've put a couple and there's been a few people putting links in, so you have to go to a page and scroll most of the way down, and then halfway down then click on a link which takes just basically downloads a Word document down to your machine. So it doesn't actually have its own, well, it does have its own dedicated web page, but when you go there, there's nothing there. It's a downloadable. And I have to say, no, I swipe at the ICO's website on occasions, but trying to unpick and get all the information about the international transfers off their website was a very, very difficult task. You know, I printed a load out and it came through with website headers and footers on, which cut out a lot of the text. So I had to then go back and do it all over again and convert it all to PDFs with a simplified. Why have they made it so complicated as a practitioner to find a way around their website to get useful information out? It just beggars belief for me.
Sorry, taking it back to
anyway.
Taking it back to the executive order. Joe, would you like to summarise what the EU's findings were? The European Commission, sorry.
Yeah, so I picked out a few key things from the executive order. So the US still does not have a federal data protection law, as you mentioned, Jasmine. The executive order is not clear, precise, or foreseeable in its application, as it can be amended at any time by the US president. Therefore, concerned about the absence of a sunset clause, which could provide that the decision would automatically expire 4 years after its entry into force. Also emphasises that adequacy decisions must include clear and strict mechanisms for monitoring and review in order to ensure that decisions are future-proof and that EU citizens' fundamental right to data protection is guaranteed. And then the third one is that the framework fails to create actual equivalence in the level of protection, calling on the Commission to continue negotiations with its US counterparts with the aim of creating a mechanism that would ensure such equivalence would provide the adequate level of protection required by Union Data Protection Law and the Charter as interpreted by the CJEU, sorry, should I say.
That ties into the potential reform of the Data Protection and Digital Information Bill with regards to adequacy not being materially lower than our, I guess, the UK's data protection legislation. So it would be interesting to see what the EU has to say about that.
Yeah, question on the chat though, you know, do we think Shrems will wade in again? Whatever we get, is Shrems going to keep wading in, or is he going to say, well, you know, I've done my bit, I'm now building my law practice, I'll just keep quiet now?
I don't think so.
Don't know.
Well,
but I mean, this is the whole thing about the American legal system is, you know, how is it that I still don't get my head around this? How is it that binding corporate rules suddenly magics away any of these concerns?
I guess it doesn't.
Well,
so that's why it's intergroup. So
yeah, but you transfer data from Ireland to America. Why have suddenly you've got no concerns about FISA?
Well,
with
I think
with it being within the group.
I think you do.
Yeah.
But then why is it okay then?
It's okay because it's safeguarding. You've highlighted the risks. So think of it a little bit kind of like a DPIA.
You highlighted risks, you're not mitigated the risks.
Well, there might be risks of it, but the part of the transfer risk assessment is to, similar to the end of a data process, data protection impact assessment, that you highlight the risks and then you state reasons as to how you try and mitigate these, or whether you reduce the risk or whether you just accept the risk. So I think the biggest risk, like you said, Phil, is FISA accepting, accessing the data that you transfer. But I think it's also worth mentioning that Section 702 of FISA is around terrorists and that sort of information. So more often than not, the data that you're transferring to America is of very low interest to FISA. So the risk is there, but it's minimal.
You might say, David's got his hand up. Come on, David, throw your two penneth in. We like a good debate.
Yeah, no, thank you. Well, two things. One on our lovable Mr. Shrems. I was lucky enough to be at IAP in Belgium, and he spoke there. And he's fully intent on challenging. He's very explicit about this. He was very flippant. He's clearly an engaging guy, but I think he will say he's going to focus on his law practice, but at the same time suggesting only because he doesn't see any way this can go ahead under the current regime. And if it does, he will challenge, but doesn't think that will be the case. So clearly he's insistent on challenging it. I think the BCIS piece is always slightly misleading in the terms of, it was never directly challenged. That's almost the reason.
No, exactly. Yeah.
So it's not, for me, it doesn't make anything go away. Shrems could go after BCRs. He doesn't do that because it's not the big win for him. But if Shrems went after BCRs, I think that, and there was some talk that BCRs have been invalidated by the piece also.
There was,
but at the moment,
there was,
that hasn't been found to be the case, or it's been found that the case law didn't directly apply to BCRs, but it doesn't really change the data impact transfer assessment piece. And I think the bigger piece for me is not almost doing the impact assessments, which I'm a massive international, we've gone through a huge piece of this. It's actually when you look at what can you do to reduce the risk, because you look at some of the suggested mechanisms to reduce risk would stop us operating as an international business. And what you really almost documented is a position of how you're showing that you're taking some of the right steps. But and finally, I think the one that I'd really like to comment on, because I think it's missed a lot in a lot of these discussions, is we're focusing on the US And I guess if you're a medium-sized business, that is probably the Microsofts, those guys, this world, where you're going to end up. If you're a big business or a really big business, I can guarantee that you massively reliant on the data centers in India, you know, the Accentures, the sort of the transactional processing hubs that are that the Indian subcontinent provides. And most risk assessments of the legislation between US and India show India to be as risky, if not more risky, than the US in terms of data transfer. And there's just no discussion on that.
Great point. Great point. Same with other countries, Brazil, you know, Mexico, you know, there's some regimes, you know, where we may be transferring data. And, you know, everyone does focus on the US. You know, it's easy to take a swipe at them, but you're quite right. There's transfers of data all over the place. And again, on the supplementary measures, you read some of the supplementary measures that either the European Data Protection Board have published or the ICO has published, and you think, OK, I can see that working, you know, unless encryption is illegal in those countries. And you look at others, you think, that's just not going to be practicable, is it?
It's not the encryption piece, is it? A lot of the encryption is about the key management for the encryption key.
Yeah, of course.
And it's back with you. And you try having an agreement with a service agreement with Microsoft over maybe not just hosting, but over your email storage and things like that. And getting them to give you the key stops them being able to actively manage and do the service that you're providing for. Yeah, and they're looking for solutions. But it's, for me, it's not the encryption, because you look at that and I would expect that everybody here who is, well, everybody here has got encryption around their core data wherever it moves. We've been doing that for years.
Mm.
But do we have copies of the keys? In most cases, I would suggest not. Key management infrastructure is quite significant. If you take on the, you know, that ownership, it is a huge risk to the entity, because you lose the key, you lose everything. Mm. So you outsource that. That's part of the service we're paying for in most of the cases. And so for me, it's not that. You know, that isn't the one, because, you know, we did in the assessment, we've gone through that steps and we went through absolutely every answer is, do we have encryption? Of course we do. And then the converse was, and where's the key? With the supplier. And that's where the challenge came in.
Mm.
I'll shut up now.
No,
it was great. All very interesting stuff. I mean, it is a complex area, you know, and the paperwork around it and the legislation around it is the guidance around it. Again, it's difficult to read. It's quite complicated to read, and it's still like at the destination point. We're still on the journey, but I still come back to. I think you're absolutely spot on. I mean, I read as well that the BCRs hadn't been challenged, but they're flimsy. You know, they're just as flimsy as the old SCCs. I think. Now, but saying that, I haven't read any of the BCRs. So I don't know exactly what the procedures say. But ultimately, if governmental organisations have got a right of access to, you know, a data center in India, regardless of what the BCR say, that right of access still exists, undermining all the EHCR stuff, in my view. Anyway,
Fiona's sorry, said in Jasmine. The chat that, no, it's okay, it's great. Fiona said in the chat that David needs his own webinar. I was thinking of inviting you along for this one in the future. thank you for that. It's really appreciated. On the talk of transfer risk assessments, you know, Zara and Joe, you both get stuck in them quite a lot. So what would you find, you know, the issues when you're completing them, and how long do they take to complete, and all of those kinds of things?
I would say how long it takes to complete varies a lot on whether we've done a transfer risk assessment on that territory before, because if you've already got the transfer risk assessment, you've already got the information about that country's legal regime, and that for me is a part which takes a lot of research, because you've got to try and understand their law and see how it differs from ours and where the risks are of that. So like America, obviously it varies from state to state, as well as they've got their federal laws, but from that it can be, there's a bit more consistency. We're slowly building a base of, you know, we've done one on Hong Kong, we've done one on Australia, we've done some other elsewhere as well. But when it's a new country, that's where it gets really tricky, trying to understand what the risks are around that and what the laws like, and trying to piece that all together. So I found a really good resource is Linklaters. That's where I often go, as like my first point of call. And then from there, I might kind of just see what other resources I can find. There are some helpful, I think OneTrust, if you use OneTrust for your transfer risk assessments, they've got some guidance in there which will tell you about the laws of different countries and the risks and how that compares. So that can make your life a little bit easier if you've got resources like that.
Yeah, a partner of ours, DP Organiser, also does the same thing. So you can search when you're undertaking risk assessments, you know, I guess benchmark the GDPR against other legislation and compare it on rights requests and I don't know, the laws around breaches and sharing and so on. So it's really useful tool. But
Yeah, which would make life a lot easier because you can just kind of use that resource library and it gives you the information there rather than having to scan through the internet and try and find which sources are reliable, trying to read them, which bits apply to you, etc.
What do you use?
So I use Linklaters is the one that I've been using, and then if not, it's kind of I just have a scan around, see what sources there are, because I think it's always worth looking across numerous sources, because if you take one at face value, you don't know if it's reliable or not, so you want to build a complete picture and piece it together with different resources, because I feel like it's more of a rounded opinion. So that's a bit which takes a bit longer. I think the key thing that I tend to think about is, well, it's similar to a DPIA, what data are we processing, what is the risk to this data? Because for example, with FISA, if I know there's no way we can stop intelligence agencies from accessing the data, then I've got to think, okay, right, well, if they do access it because I can't stop it, what risk am I accepting by doing this? If it's minimal data, if it's, you know, a name and email address and that's all they're going to get from it, then I'm going to think, okay, that it's more access than they should be having. I don't want them to have it, but is there much of a risk of harm to the data subject from this access? Whereas I'm thinking, if I'm going to be sending criminal conviction data to America, I'm going to be a lot more unsure about whether I want FISA to be able to access that data, and that's where I'd be much more concerned about that, the potential for access there. So the data sending over has a big kind of implication on the transfer risk assessment and what the outcome is going to be based on the risk that then posed within the transfer risk assessment, really. But yeah, so they're a bit long. They're a bit you want to be thorough, though, to be fair. But they do take a lot of time. But obviously, it's what's needed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Jason said in the chat that they perform many TRAs using the DLA Piper tool, which he's mentioned before. So it's great because they've done all the work on evaluating the human rights, data protection and other laws of all countries. But more importantly, focuses not just on the country, but a specific importer and, if appropriate, all their sub-processors who may be in other further third countries. That sounds really good. And Cameron has put a link to it in the chat, I believe. Yeah. So thank you for that. But yeah, I've watched you both in the office getting stuck into them, and to be honest, I don't envy you as you're doing them.
Yeah, they're not great.
So once you've done a TRA, then what conclusion do you make? You know, where do you go from there? What's the next step?
So the way that I approach it is, you've got the risk assessment, the end of the transfer risk assessment, where you kind of go through what the risks are, what you're going to do to mitigate the risk, are you going to accept it, what effect is that going to have on the risk, et cetera, et cetera. And then, because you need to make a decision off the basis of that, if you get to the end of the transfer risk assessment and you go, I'm not happy with this transfer actually, then I'd be looking at, is there an alternative? Can we use a different provider then? If we're not willing to accept the risk, then why would we be proceeding with the transfer? So that's why, for me, I think procedurally within an organisation, it's important to do the transfer risk assessment first before you then enter into any contract with the organisation. So then from there, essentially, it's what contractual measure do you need to have in place? Quite often, if you're looking at Amazon, if you're looking at any large organisation, within their T's and C's on the website, they'll include the European, the EU standard contractual clauses and the UK addendum, because that way they can they can cover EU data coming over and UK data coming over. So it's easy to do it in that sense rather than having the EUSCs and the whole IDTA, International Data Transfer Agreement. So quite often it'll be the EUSCs and the UK addendum that organisations will have in place rather than the IDTA. But so essentially you just need to have a
you do the TRA, right? I mean, again, yeah. I think we've possibly got a slightly different perspective than many of the colleagues on this podcast. So we're acting as advisors, aren't we, to our clients? And I would have thought that in potentially, you know, there's different pressures internally if you're a DPO in an international organization, and if you're an advisor, it's quite easy. Mm-hmm. Easier potentially for us to say decision point D, decision point E, you need the TRA tool saying, oh no, this isn't good enough, this isn't good enough, this isn't good enough, you know, good luck. If you're internally in the organization, you're going to get pressures internally, you know, this has to go ahead, it's mission critical. Yeah. So
we get them pressures too.
Well, I'm just wondering on these decision points, you know, I mean, from people who've done, you know, other people have done them. You know what it's a decision, isn't it? It's a value judgment. It's subjective. You know, what are we recording on these TRAs? Are we recording that we think actually it's okay after all, or are we recording that we actually think that there are significant risks to people's human rights and everything else in these decision points in the TRA tool? And then what? You know, what happens then?
I guess it's similar to a DPIA, isn't it? You know, what does the organisation do? Are you going to accept the risk or are you not? It's no one's going to be there telling you, like the RCA is not going to be there at the step before you transfer the data, so you can't do it.
It's a decision we have to take, isn't it? And you know, and we have to accept the potential risk. We have to mitigate the risk. It's like everything that we do in this field, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. I think it's also worth mentioning, Phil, that TRAs are not actually a legal requirement. They were just off the back of Schrems 2 case law. So it's not actually in the GDPR that you have to do a TRA. So if
If you don't do it, I think you'd be in for the high jump couldn't demonstrate. It's the risk assessment. GDPR doesn't specifically refer to a TRA, but it does say that, you know, transfers have got to be, well, processing has got to be risk-based, hasn't it?
Yeah, similar to data sharing agreements, I suppose. Cameron has asked in the chat, so do we, DPP, use the ICO's approach to TRAs or the European Data Protection Boards? Because the ICO says that you can use either.
I think we depend use whatever our customer uses. So Vicky was doing some work the other day with a client, and they've been instructed, because they're mostly a processor, they've been instructed to use the European model. Whereas, you know, other clients of ours aren't they're affected by that. So they would use the ICO model. So I think it depends horses for courses. I quite like aspects of both of them.
I've done, when I did some, I did them on the ICOs. One which was, it was a bit tricky to navigate, because it's, you have like 20 pages and then you have a like table to complete, then another like 3 pages, and then you've got a bit you need to fill in and another bit to fill in, and then you've got another table and then a few pages. It's very spread out. But
yeah, it some bits of it are quite good in structurally in the way it goes through, you know, those six questions and that. But I think it's a bit clunky, but it gives you a framework, doesn't it? It gives you quite a good framework to work through. And presumably, if you go through that framework and you fill it in completely and honestly, then hopefully you've documented the rationale behind your decision and the various considerations.
Which is what you need for accountability, really. So,
yeah, exactly. That principle. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
So I think we've reached the hour mark. It's been a great session. There's loads to talk about. I think we could unpick all of it in further detail, probably on a second session. There's been loads of contribution in the chat, and thank you very much everyone and our hosts this week for all of your contributions.
Yeah, thank you everyone.
Sorry,
Phil's not done.
Now reading the chat.
Right, okay. Is there anything that you wanted to discuss before we close?
No, thank you very much, everyone. Thank you, Jasmine. Thank you, Joe. Thank you, Zara. And hopefully everyone have a good weekend, and we'll see you next week. Actually, I won't see you next week, because I'm in Ireland next week, Friday.
Okay, well, we'll see you next week with GDPR Radio. So thank you, everyone, and have a good weekend.
Cheers, guys. See you later.
See you.
Bye. Thank you.